I'm sure Dave panicked when I wasn't here, but I was giving another talk, so. I want to spend a little bit of time this afternoon just talking about how we're going to characterize uncertainty in this whole thing that's really, and John kind of laid a good message, and I'll go off of that. And we did not coordinate these talks, so. Really, what is agri-system or agro-ecosystem resilience in all of this? Because resilience has sort of become the 2010 to the current buzzword that we had sustainability before. Everybody wants to have resilience, but I'm not sure that anybody has a good definition of resilience in all of this. And I'm going to kind of weave that story for you as we go through this. But I was back looking at the literature through this in terms of just how people put different metrics to agri-system resilience. And this is a paper by Cabell and Olfsey that's in Ecology and Society. And I spend a lot of time with sociologists right now and everything and really talking about this, because if you look at all of these different indicators that they came up with as they were surveying people, is that it ranges a lot, and you go from sociologically self-organized in terms of a resilient system all the way down to reasonably profitable at the end of this. And they didn't put any metrics on what was reasonably profitable. But you look at all of this, and you begin to draw the picture together that when we really talk about an agro-ecosystem, that really becomes this structure. That it's part of the food system. And John laid out in terms of the practices between conventional and organic system. Really, what are we talking about in terms of a food system out there? Or what do we talk about when we talk about a feed system? Or all of this. But the point of all of this is that sometimes when we go down this track of looking at agro-ecosystem resilience relative to climate change, and I have spent a lot of time on that, is that we forget there's a human component. That we cannot build agro-ecosystem resilience without the linkage of the human component, because that resilience really is a complex mixture of social and ecological interactions. That really becomes a viewpoint that we need to understand. How do people process information? How do they value information? And how do they utilize that information from all of this? And so the human view of agroecosystems is not about production. It really is about how the pieces fit together in many different ways than you and I imagine. Because we could say that a resilient agroecosystem in a corn-soybean system, which is basically the Midwest, just if you look across the 8 Midwestern states, 75% of our land area is consumed in corn and soybeans. 25%, I tell people, is in all other crops and classified as specialty crops, because that goes everything from alfalfa to sweet corn to asparagus to wine grapes, cherries, and everything else. But each one of those, the resilience factor is dependent upon the producer's ability to understand the forces that are taking place out there. The uncertainty component is just not about the physical environment. The uncertainty component is how well that manager can process the information to be able to understand what the signals are from all the different viewpoints in this. And so I pulled out three indicators in that whole list of them that were very specific to agriculture and began to delve into what Cabell and Olfsey were talking about in terms of looking at resilience from their standpoint. And if you just look at it from an ecological self-regulation point of view, is that we have to align our production with ecological parameters. And that is really looking and saying, what's the best thing to really be looking at across here in terms of where the ecology is going and all of this? What's the diversity of plant cover across the landscape? And then what is this other factor that's really about the habitat? And if you really think about the habitat structure of a landscape, and you talk about agroecosystem resilience, a lot of that really becomes about pollinators, birds, a lot of the other factors that are there. And then you end up with this other piece of this is the spatial and temporal heterogeneity. Because if you take a viewpoint of an Easterner driving across the Midwest, their view is that we only grow two things. We only grow corn, and we only grow soybeans, and we're taking the trees out of the landscape because they see all those bulldozed along windbreaks and streams as well. So we don't value, in terms of this agroecosystem, patchiness. We talk about all these different things that are going on. We don't value diverse cultural practices. And we don't really value crop rotations. Because we, if you look at building resilience in corn and soybean systems, we're talking about how do we optimize basically a summer annual monoculture from lots of different viewpoints. And then the other piece of this that I want to pull out, and we'll spend more time on this one, is how this ecosystem is exposed to disturbance. How is it exposed to disturbance? And the disturbance that we're talking about is the changing climate that we have, this increasing variability of weather, and there are events which cause disturbance without pushing the system beyond the critical threshold. You know, what is that level of disturbance that we can tolerate without causing a collapse? And so it really gets to a very interesting point. And I want to go back and just spend just one piece on this spatial and temporal heterogeneity. Because if you look at the Midwest culture, and you look at the Midwest agroecosystem, we really talk about how we're influencing nitrate levels, how we're influencing soil erosion levels, how we're having a lot more dynamics going on in this landscape. And if we go back and you look 50 years ago, 60 years ago, we had a very mixed rotation system. We had all sorts of different strategies going on in our landscape. And starting in the 70s, when we moved exclusively to corn and soybeans, is when our nitrates in the stream started really increasing. Our nitrate problems are not caused by how we fertilize the crop. Our nitrate issues are caused by how we've done away with the rotation of that system and all of this. So you really look at this from a spatial and heterogeneity point of view, it becomes quite dynamic. And this disturbance is really about this deviations from what we assume to be normal weather. It's because it's extremes that are in there. How do these disturbances impact production? And how do these disturbances impact crop diversity as well, or the lack of crop diversity? So you can kind of begin to track and begin to look and say, what do disturbances mean in all of this? And you can put your own definition with those as you go along. But let's just look at it from this perspective. And I just plotted out Story County, Iowa. This is corn production since 1950. All the dots are across there. You see all those are individual years. These are the NAS data out there. You see that in the 50s and the 60s, we basically had, let's see what we have. Oops. If you go back and you look in the 50s and the 60s, we really had very stable production. We had very little influences of weather on that. We've got very variable. But you look at the last 10 years, all the spread around that trend line, and we continue to get there. And the question that producers want to know when you talk about agroecosystem resilience is what the production is going to be in future years. Because the tendency is that we're spreading it more and more. And so what is that production going to look like? And one of the metrics that we've been looking at in this is basically to go and look at lost production. Lost production is basically planted minus harvested times the average county yield per area. And you look at this, and we've had some years in the early 70s, which we had a lot of weather extremes. We lost a lot of production. The biggest one, back in 2008, when we had a lot of flooding across the state, we had a lot of lost production. But that becomes a very interesting metric when you just look and begin to see what did we plant relative to what we harvested and what was that worth to us. Because a producer looks at it and says, you know, I really got to think about some different things to change. The unfortunate part, and John mentioned it as well, is that our policy really kind of prevents us from making good, great strides on that, because all of that lost production is offset by crop insurance. And so we have a safety net that really puts a false economy on what we need to be thinking about in terms of agroecosystem resilience as well. And so so we've been looking at agricultural models and saying, how do we account for the variation in future weather conditions and climate patterns? If we're going to talk about what the level of disturbance is and where are we going in the future and how do we begin to change this system, we're going to have to begin to look into the future and how do we account for that. Producers want two things. They'd really like to know next season, very, very specifically. And when we want them to start thinking about practices, long-term, 5 to 10 years, and they'd like that with the same precision as next season as well. You know, they really are very conservative from that viewpoint. And just to give you a couple ideas of what's changing out here, to give you an idea of how uncertain it's going to become, this is annual rainfall for the state of Missouri, and then we've split it into the two lower lines. The red line is spring, and the blue line at the bottom, or the green line, is actually summer. April, May, June, July, August, September. And you begin to see that annual precipitation in Missouri has gone up. We've actually had a little bit increase in summer spring precipitation, and a slight decrease in summer precipitation. Not as dramatic as Iowa, however. Annual precipitation has really gone up across the state, almost 5 inches over that 115-year period. But the real trend line is that we're having more precipitation in the spring, less precipitation in the summer. And if you look at that variation about that line, it's getting larger and larger. So our climate signal right now already has lots of uncertainty in it. And everybody wants us to project into the future. How do we begin to build a more resilient system to be able to do that? If you look at it, this is just a plot of a recomputation of the 30-year normals, because we tend to look at this 30-year normal and we forget about the last 30-year normal. So we basically put all the 30-year normals in a trajectory. So you begin to see, and that 30-year normal, that gold dotted line across there, is this increase in the 30-year normal of the annual precipitation. The lines that are above and below that are 95% confidence limit. But what you see is that we have more events or more years above that 95% confidence limit in the last 30 years than we've had in the past. So we're getting more and more of these extreme total events that are very high precipitation. We've changed the annual or the spring precipitation so much across the Midwest that we've reduced the number of workable field days by almost 4 days in this April through mid-May period. 4 days out of a 6-week period is a very dramatic change in terms of our ability to get things done. So the producer faces some uncertainty because of a shifting climate pattern and what it means. And so what we've done in all of this, and I'm just going to use one crop model example, and this is some of the things that we've done with the AgMIP project, where we've taken ensembles of models. This is just looking at low level of information and high levels of information, and how we feed the different models. Low levels of information are very sketchy soils information, climate data, and just a little bit of crop parameters. The right side with a high level of information is we've given them a great deal of information of how that crop was growing. You can see that when we give you more and more information in crop models, you do a better job of simulating. The box plots are in there. Look at all of this in terms of this, and these are four different locations. And then we've even gone in the lower left hand, how many models do we really have to average? Because we're convinced that if we're going to go into the future, that we need to be thinking about ensembles of models to do this rather than the perfect model, because we're not sure we'll ever get the perfect model, but we can get a lot of imperfect ones that get a mean as well. And all of this, as we go forward, we've looked at what really is going to happen in terms of production along the way. If you look at just running these suites of models relative to temperature increase, average decline in increasing temperature is about 5, almost 6% relative to per degree C in there. So variability is going to increase in terms of production going forward. What's encouraging about that is that that number is very close to what we see in experimental data, of which is almost 6 to 7% decline over time as we go with that. And then you see those are the different ensembles in there. There are a few lines that really go up, and we're trying to figure out what is why those models behave the way they do. And it really comes down to the fact that one of the pieces that we work on in this is what's the changing temperature and moisture interactions within these models and within plant growth as we go on. And this is CO2 data. If we look at this, is that there's a positive impact of increasing CO2, but it comes with high variability. And it comes with a high variability because as we increase CO2, we're also going into a different temperature regime as well. So there's other pieces that we've been looking at, and how do we really take climate models in this? This is some. This is just a diagram of how we're really taking current climate into future climate, downscaling it so it really represents this, and all these different pieces. But I just wanted to show one example of the projected changes in solar radiation coming out of this. And this is looking at change in mean solar radiation from 1995 to projected to 2060. And you look at this in the winter precipitation or winter solar radiation, basically not a lot of change. In the spring, there's a slight decrease going across the upper Midwest. Again, you would expect that because we're changing the whole precipitation pattern with more clouds out there. Summer, the good news is that we're going to have a slight increase in solar radiation in this. Bad news is that we're not going to have any water to grow the crop. So, you know, that becomes an additional uncertainty in all of this, and it goes back to this fact that we're going to have to manage our soils differently, and you look across that landscape to be able to handle these dynamics. So here's the critical gaps as we go forward. Is how do we project to temperature scenarios? How do we project temperature scenario or precipitation scenarios? And how do we couple those with suites of crop models to give us an estimate of uncertainty in all of this? Because just to give you a couple more examples, is that here's the regime that we're already in. These are seasonal minimum temperatures, and minimum temperatures have become to be quite impactful in terms of how we influence production in there. And you see that just the years laid outside of this is May, June versus July, August. We do all sorts of analyses with that. Is that what we've had in the last 5 years is kind of laid outside the envelope of what we've seen since 1895. And we see the same thing in summer rainfall in Illinois, spring versus summer. Is the last 5 years have become much more dynamic in terms of the overall suite of what we've had in the past. So we live in an entirely different climate regime in terms of casting more uncertainty on this. But if we want to create resilience, is that we're going to have to rely on models to create a future set of scenarios for us. But we're going to have to couple these climate models on projected patterns of temperature and precipitation. How do we look at that? The uncertainty in the impacts on productivity is going to require an assessment of impact on crop response and potential adaptation strategies. How do we really begin to couple these things together? How do you look at the whole aspect of changing crop rotations in part of this? To look at this agroecosystem as a much different view than just a single field, because the agroecosystem is really about the landscape. It's not about an individual field. It really becomes a landscape type of feature as well. And you look at this, just some Mishra and Checkhart data. Again, the declines, and that's that 7% that we see both in corn and soybeans with the increasing temperature along the way. So here's our challenges that if we're going to build resilience into this, is that the crop models are now going to have to account for the effect of future climates on both trend and seasonality, because we often assume that there's a trend, but we don't really put much of a seasonality piece in it. And the seasonality is going to really influence a lot of this. This uncertainty is going to arise when we have scenarios of future change, and we see that in the climate models, is that expected broadness, more variability in precipitation, more variability in our temperature impacts as well, and combinations of temperature and precipitation throughout the whole growing season. Don't expect it all to be one clump as well. And they're going to have to accommodate changing crops and cropping practices. And because as we change this overall system, it's really not just about the above ground part. It's really going to be about how we change and look at the models of the below ground part in terms of the soils, in terms of the water holding capacity, the dynamics that go on that. And they're going to have to accommodate this potential for changing crops and looking at the landscape rather than the field scale. We've spent so much time looking at resilience of the field, but in order, we really are going to have to look at resilience of the landscape, because that's where we're going to have the biggest impact. Producers tend to look at this from a multiple field perspective. They don't always look at their field. They don't even look at their field as an individual piece as well, is that they really do farm multiple places in all of this. So we're going to have to be able to help them do a number of different things from that perspective. So with that, I left you time for questions. Yes, ma'am. Good question, because we have primary effects in terms of productions. We have all the secondary, tertiary effects in terms of all the dynamics that go on. And Dave didn't give me an hour. blame it on Dave. And if you go back to that original slide and you talk about all those different indicators, there's really where you begin to see the secondary and tertiary effects. And I really worry, and that's why I brought in a little bit of the habitat piece, because as we change the dynamics of the landscape, I think the habitat, and I'll just use pollinators as an example, and I'll use an example out of nothing agronomic, but in perennial crops in terms of tree crops, because one of the questions that comes up right now is, what's the uncertainty in the flowering date? And how do you begin to transport bees from California back into the Midwest for those tree crops as well? And that really has become a very uncertain piece of that. And that's a secondary and tertiary effect. The other piece that I worry about in this whole thing, when we talk about inputs to grow these crops, and I'll follow that, is how do we look at the whole dynamics of water quality as an issue? In terms of what we placed on that crop, what's the dynamics of the rainfall pattern, and how is that influencing the water quality dynamics? And if you look at this and say, how do we manage this landscape? not only to improve water quality, but also the productive at the asp- or the productivity of that landscape as well. And if you look at that, the piece that I think we need to have more discussion on is a concept that the Europeans have used for a number of years. We don't use it in the U.S., and that's the multifunctionality of agriculture. And I really think that we've got to have that system become part of our vocabulary so that we can really understand the trade-offs that go on as well as the opportunities that exist within that. Gosh, everything was perfectly clear. There's no.
All right.
Yes, sir.
How the very last graph or the next to last graph that shows increase in temperatures, decreased corn yield. How is that research done?
How's that research done? And that one was done by taking existing data and looking at high temperature events that occurred within a data set. We've done other ones in where we've actually exposed corn and soybeans to the high temperatures within rhizotrons that we can grow a plant to maturity. You see some of the same thing in phase data where they control CO2 and then they also add temperatures to it, is that remarkably across a lot of those experiments we're seeing that 6-7% decline in yield relative to per degree. But what really changed, and I didn't show this in the data set, is that we're changing our minimum temperatures more than we're changing our maximum temperatures. Our mins are increasing, our maximums are actually going down across a lot of the Midwest. The minimum temperatures during the grain filling period have a tremendous impact. I'll use 1 year as an example for you. 2010, we had some of our highest nighttime temperatures that we've seen in a long time. And we collapsed the grain filling period by about 15 days across the upper Midwest. We took about 20 to 30 bushels off of the NAS projection in July to September just because of that increased temperature. And so we're seeing, in fact, I'll shock you with some numbers, is that when we've taken corn and grown it at normal Ames temperatures, and then I grew it at 4 degrees centigrade above normal, is that I took the yields down 75%. I really collapsed that, and it was due to the fact of exposing that plant to high nighttime temperatures during the grain filling period. So we're going to have to think differently if we ever get the 4°C+ on the average in terms of the dynamics that are out there. So the uncertainty is going to come not on the mean temperature, but how the max and mins are changing. And that's why we look at the seasonality of precipitation, because that's the other variable that I think is going to increase even more uncertainty in our dynamics out there. No, actually you won't, because I have to go give another talk. So.
All right, Jerry. Thank you very much.